Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Have you sampled the Fallout show yet? Did you get a chance to watch some of it last night?
Not yet. Everyone's so positive on it, like you and Dan included, that I'm going to have to watch it. I wasn't planning on doing it necessarily, just because of my thing of I don't like to start stuff that don't have an ending. So I was going to keep away from it. But everyone just is gushing over it. So I've got to see what the crack is. And I've got to see what they do to my beloved New Vegas, if they do anything to it.
Cool. Right. Scott just sort of like starts in the middle of a conversation, doesn't he? Okay. Well, in that case, welcome to the Untitled Banter Podcast. The UBP. I am not Scott Telford, of course. I'm your host, Si White, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Si White.
How are you?
I'm all right on this Friday. We said before we started recording that this has kind of been a week of Wednesdays, which is so
really
true.
Has.
Don't know how everyone listening to this has felt about this week, but considering we're into April and I thought we were going to get a nice little reset, I'm starting to think it's the Wednesday of the year.
2020 Wednesday.
Yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah, sure. We're going to get through as many questions as we can on this episode, as usual. So thank you to everyone. I put the tweet out this time. A bit of a change of pace, obviously. And not having Scott on, a bit of a change of pace as well. But we'll do what we can. Let's get into it. Gravity Cause Nerd Pod with the first question. In honor of Scott being a father now, what game that allows you to be a parent / parental figure is your favourite? Mine would be Witcher 3. Josh?
Oh, Witcher 3 is a great shout. I'm going to have to go extremely obvious with my pick, but it's got to be The Last of Us for me.
Oh, okay.
For me, it's always fascinating in the first game, the way that Joel kind of implants Sarah onto Ellie. Like, towards the end, I always think it's really interesting when he talks about how they'd be friends, yet kind of you think, would they be friends? You know, is he trying to like kind of force this narrative a little bit? I think it's obviously it gets lumped into the kind of sad dad genre of video games, but I think it has like a lot of depth to it, especially by the time we get to part two when we get that kind of fractured relationship and the idea that she maybe wasn't able to forgive Joel until he was no longer in her life and the kind of I'm really doing this an injustice, but the idea that, you know, you almost don't know your parents until you can't know them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a whole weird feeling, isn't there, I guess, about when you sort of crack into their life before you a little bit. When you get to a certain point, you can have those conversations, or maybe you can't, and you just discover something in the attic one day, and you're like, oh yeah, this is who you actually were before you were my parent. So yeah, there's a lot of like nuance in The Last of Us. I thought you were going to go with my obvious pick, which is a nice wholesome one.
Go on.
Which is The Sims. I don't know if that counts. You're not playing as the Sim, are you? You're just kind of playing God. But
it's one of those
because in not many video games do the children grow up and become the main character. And with Sims, that's kind of in perpetuity if you play it long enough, right? We go through generations where you watch the kid grow up, so you get attached to him, and then they're the adults that you start directing around. The other one, I'm glad you said about sad dads, I wanted to shout out, was Alan Wake 2 with Saga
yes.
being a main character who's a mother, which is so rare in video games. Like, we have so many sad dads. We need to start the campaign now for, like, badass mums. Because there's just, like, really not that many of them. So it was her story, obviously integral with her relationship with her daughter. That's a big part of Alan Wake 2. I won't get into it because it's still new-ish and it's quite spoilery. But that's, like, her driving force. Yeah, it'd just be nice to see a bit more mums picking up guns to protect their kids in video games for once.
Mums picking up guns. Amazing. That's a good shout. Like, I wouldn't have even thought of Alan Wake 2, but it's probably for that reason in my ignorance that when I think of, you know, parents and video games, I go straight to that arguably overdone sad dad genre when Alan Wake 2 is such a perfect example. And I think that works, again, without spoiling it too much, so well, because Saga sort of relationship to motherhood is so important in that game, yet you know, it makes a point of keeping her distanced from her child throughout it, which is an interesting way to do it, where you don't have the scenes of them kind of bonding. It's just all through kind of Saga's lens and a voice over the phone as she kind of tries to get in touch with her daughter.
Can you think of any other cool mums in video games? Because I've got, it's that, like, I wouldn't say cool, but there's a big boss, I guess, in MGS. She's a badass mum, but I don't know.
I think, you know, I my mind kind of goes to maybe, is it Freya in God of War and God of War
Yeah,
Ragnarok,
that's fair.
The mother of Baldur. I think what they do with her in the sequel is really good, because at the end of God of War 2018, for as good as it was, I kind of didn't want her to slide into total villainy over kind of wanting revenge for Baldur and Kratos killing him, and she definitely is out for revenge, but that portrayal is much more nuanced, and I thought that was great to see, because Kratos himself is afforded so much nuance as a parent, and then in God of War Ragnarok, you get a full spectrum of nuanced parents in that game, from Kratos to Freya to Faye to Odin to Thor to everyone else, and that I think, maybe the ultimate game about parenthood.
Who'd have thought way back God of War 1, this is going to be the ultimate parent simulator game.
I know, right? Si, let me ask you about The Sims, because I could never get into The Sims because it just gave me an existential crisis every single time. Even caring for children in digital form was too much and it stressed me out too much. So, and I don't think I ever got past the baby stage when I ever played Sims. Like, I got two people together. They ended up having a baby, but then I kind of just quit out because I was like, this is too much. I can't even keep on top of the dishes in this game. Never mind, look after a tiny digital child.
No, to be honest, very much the same thing, actually, yeah. Because you're so attached to your Sims by that point. You've got them a job. You've guided them through a relationship that you've basically forced on them and all this stuff. Sims is weird. But yeah, then a child comes into it and you're like, oh, no, I'm doubly invested now because it's the character I've been taking care of and their offspring, this defenseless creature. So I'm not sure I've ever actually done it. I mentioned, you know, going through the generations. It's something that can theoretically be done. But you got to put some time in to the Sims to get that point, I think, right? Or whereas what I did, as people are vaguely aware of, I was going to make a video out of this and I still never got around to it, but I made that What Culture Gaming Sims house.
Yes.
I used it in a video once forever ago and we were going to do something with it. But all I did was basically put us in a house and see how long it took for all of us to die. Who's going to set fire to who first? You know, that's how people... That's what The Sims is for, right?
That's amazing. That is what The Sims is for. And I think, you know, when I first played it, I didn't know what The Sims was for because everyone that I knew who played it just put the cheats on, you know, and went absolutely mad. But for some reason, I couldn't even get them to work because it's a computer game and I'm not very smart when it comes to technology. And honestly, I had a hard time with it. So I ended up playing it normal. And I was thinking all the way through, like, how do you all play this? This is overwhelming. Like, where does the fun start? I'm just doing dishes and looking after my sim and make sure they're not depressed. And I'm like, it's hard enough to do that in real life, never mind in video game form.
There's got to be a weird examination there, isn't it? It's like, I can't do that for me, but I can do it for this person. Yeah. It's not real.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, it's a good practice run, isn't it? Even if that practice run is, like you said, just putting all of us who work at this job in a room and seeing who murders who first.
I think it was you, actually, funnily enough. Literally, I boot up the game, straight to the barbecue, sets fire to it. Hey, just fire everywhere. Everyone's panicking.
I'd believe that, you know. I never use a barbecue in real life, and that's why. It's a go. Premonition that.
Practice run, like you say. There you go. Now you know you can't, because the sim couldn't. Jack Jinjo asks, what's your favourite game that when initially getting it was picked without any real knowledge of what it actually was? I remember getting my PlayStation 1 from Argos and having to pick two games with my mum. Disney's Hercules and Broken Sword 2, name a better duo. I've got to put that in there because I know you and I both love Disney's Hercules.
Yes, goated game, absolutely. And I'm not just saying that because it's the first one I ever played. It is amazing. I've got a few for this side, but what comes to mind for you?
This brought to fore a very specific memory of, I don't think it was when I got my Xbox 360, but it was early into it. And it was a couple years after the console had come out, and I was just like looking to pick up some games to bulk up that library a little bit. And I think actually, as I say this, I think it was Argos, coincidentally, but it was one of these where it was like two for whatever and the selection of games. And I was a big Sonic fan, and I knew that it was terrible, but I wanted to experience it myself and get my own sort of opinion on it. So it was the 2006 Sonic the Hedgehog was the game from that selection. And I was looking at the rest and I was like, none of these stand out to me. And my partner at the time was like, just get Viva Pinata. That looks good. Played Sonic 06 for about 10 minutes, went, this is trash. Viva Pinata played until like 3 a.m. I've put hundreds of hours into both Viva Pinata games and had no idea what it was to begin with, but it just stole my soul after that. So there
what
you go.
What a beautiful little story. Like, even though Sonic sucked, you still got a little bit of magic out of that.
Yeah,
versus
a lot of bit of magic.
That's actually sparked it. I didn't think of that element, but in a similar way, I remember, you know, going to Game Station, as it was back in the day before it closed down in the UK, and they used to always run those deals on, for me, it was PlayStation 2 games primarily, you know, five for 20 quid, five for 30, or whatever it was in these pre-owned titles. So I used to do similar things where I'd go in for one thing and then just pick up whatever looked good off the shelves.
Yeah.
And I was always trading in games, and I was always rebuying games that I used to play over and over again. I must have bought X-Men 2 Wolverine's Revenge about 20 times by trading it in for other stuff and going, oh, no, I actually
probably the
really
same copy.
That game. Yeah, probably.
Why not taking your own copy home?
Going to recycle it over and over again. I remember picking up, I always want to call it Band of Brothers, but it's not. It's called Brothers in Arms. By doing that and really enjoying it. The same with the first Borderlands, which I kind of knew nothing about at the time and didn't even know if it was going to be my thing, and then picked it up and really enjoyed it. But honestly, I don't know how you approach games now, but before, because I guess it was so rare to, especially buy a new game, but kind of buy any games, I would always do my due diligence, usually, before going out to at least get one that I knew I really wanted. So I would be looking at all the reviews, scouring all the discussions, to make sure it was kind of worthy of being one of four or five games I got that year. But now, with, you know, subscription services especially, and with games kind of fluctuating in price and being able to afford a lot of indies for, you know, much cheaper, I'm very much someone who judges a book by its cover. And I know, controversial, probably shouldn't do that in real life, but I think in video games it's sound advice, because there have been so many times where I've just seen a cover that looks cool and gone, I want to see what that's all about. You know, I did it with Immortality, which became one of my favorite games ever. I did it with Stay Out of the House last year, which I absolutely adored. So it's, I've got more hits through that than misses by now. So now I'm kind of willing to just take a chance on something if the cover looks cool and the blurb sounds fun.
That's fair. I mean, I get that. Like, mine is when everyone's talking about a certain game, or people that I, you know, trust the opinion on are talking about something. If I hear something I like about it, it'll be like, okay, don't tell me any more. I'm just going to go and jump into it if I can. And I wouldn't have done that before. Now I'm, you know, living the days of my own disposable income a little bit more. I can kind of afford to take a few more risks if I feel like it, because yeah, like you, it would have been a few games a year. So I have to do the research, or it has to be a franchise that I trust enough or am invested in. See Sonic 2006.
Yes.
Don't care the reviews about it. It's Sonic, so I have to at least give it a go, that kind of thing. But yeah, now it is kind of like, do you know what? I kind of want to know as little as possible sometimes.
Absolutely.
Especially with indie games.
Yeah, I'm fully on board with that. Like, especially for me, it's actually especially the big AAA games, kind of like your Sonics, that you know you're going to buy sort of regardless. Like,
yeah,
a new Spider-Man game comes out, whether it's made by Insomniac or made by Beenox, I'm such a Spider-Man mark, I'm probably going to buy it, right? So in that situation, I kind of keep away from previews or reviews or whatever it is, because I already know I'm going to buy it. And anything that is a surprise, especially now when I think you know so much about a game or can know so much about a game going in, savoring those surprises, savoring that kind of first run experience, I find just really, 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 really nice. I was going to say something else there, Si, jumping off what you said, but I've totally forgotten it because you made another great point and now I can't remember. So maybe it's gone. I think it's gone.
Okay. Sorry, I apologize for my great point.
Yeah, no, you're making too many great points.
On the Spider-Man thing, it just made me think, because like Spider-Man 2, I remember the launch trailer for that coming out like a couple of days beforehand showed the Sandman boss fight.
Yeah.
And I remember Ewan was doing the review for it and he was just like, don't watch that trailer. It's right at the beginning of the game, but you want that first impression yourself. And yeah, just one of the many, 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 many examples of, I wish I hadn't watched that trailer because I already was going to buy it. Why did I do that? You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example because I kept away from that trailer. But then when everyone was publishing their reviews, and you know, rightly so, it's footage from something that has officially been released, but a lot of them used the thumbnail from that Sandman fight. And I kind of remember just seeing those and thinking, I could have done without seeing that. Honestly, I could have done without seeing the trailer before when you saw Peter in the symbiote costume. Even that was kind of a step too far for me in showing Lizard. I have remembered what I was going to say, though. You mentioned, you know, when you get kind of halfway through someone recommending something to you and you kind of put a pin in it and say, right, that's all I need to know. I'm going to go try this game. I do that a lot with video essays. Like, there are a few YouTubers who I watch religiously, like Noah Caldwell-Gervais or Jacob Geller. And when they're talking about a video game, if I haven't played it and they kind of give me the sales pitch, I'll pause the video and just go, right, I'm going to play this game before I come back to it. Or sometimes if they drop a big, I remember Noah Caldwell-Gervais dropped a big God of War retrospective going through all the games. And I thought, well, now is a perfect time for me to go through all the games. So I went through God of War 1, 2, and 3 and replayed God of War 2018 to kind of unlock that content, because I love...
That's awesome. I love that.
Interspersing like all of those different sort of mediums together and having a nice little God of War loving or whatever it is to be able to consume the game yourself, have your own thoughts in it, and then go watch some like really good analysis of that game and just kind of continue the thrill.
Oh, I love that. Pinky asks, well, Pinky says, you to the matriarch fornicating pee other buckets. This feels like an appropriate time to ask where the Deathclaw fiddling Maya lurk ever happened to the Fallout 4 next gen update. I want my shiny 60fps slow-mo headshots. I'm not massively on top of this one because I'm not a big Fallout fan, but they've announced like a collection of everything except Fallout 4. Is that where this comes from?
Well, you know
what,
Pinky?
Is that a thing?
It's hilarious because they announced the Fallout 4 remaster, I guess, update for next gen consoles, and it was supposed to come out last year and then it didn't. But then literally last night, they announced it was finally coming at the end of April. So it is happening now. So we actually do have an answer to this, which is amazing. But it took way too long. And I think, in a way, they've actually benefited from delaying it, because everyone seems to be watching the show and going, oh, I really want to play Fallout. And now they're literally going to have this update ready in a few weeks so people can watch the show and then jump into Fallout 4 again.
Ah, I see. It was a long play. I imagine that was probably on purpose, right?
Yeah, it's got... Oh, yeah, it must have been. That, like, because they just did not mention it last year. And then now it's coincidentally coming out the same month as the show. I'm sure someone at Bethesda thought, well, we can capitalize on this. You're not much of a Fallout game fan, are you, Si? Or am I putting words in your mouth there?
No, I mean, yeah, kind of. It's not any particular issue with Fallout that I have. I kind of bounce off Western RPGs a lot anyway. It takes a lot for me to get into them. And every Bethesda game I've tried, I always get really excited about the idea. And like, I'll watch some videos on it or watch someone else play it, and I'm like, this looks awesome. And then I'll get, you know, half a dozen hours in and I just like, I don't know, I'm not really invested. The systems don't do it for me. Whatever it is. I just, just kind of doesn't click for me, unfortunately. I would love to, because Fallout, and I said this on the podcast that dropped yesterday, is one of those worlds that just seems awesome, and I would love to know more about the lore. So I'm very happy about the TV series dropping, because I get to have a... I wouldn't say an entry point, because I don't think it's going to drive me towards any Fallout games, because I already know what's going to happen. I'm going to put 6 hours in, and then I'm going to bounce right off again.
Yeah.
But it's I can at least appreciate and enjoy some Fallout content without having to play the game, which sounds really weird, but yeah.
Well, I think that's kind of what, you know, I understand the argument, and you might have touched on this yesterday. I'm not actually sure. I've been saving that podcast when I watched the show myself.
There you go.
Lazy getting around to it. But I understand the argument that a lot of, especially gaming fans, bring to these gaming adaptations, where they say, you know, why do we need an adaptation of The Last of Us, for instance, when it's so close to the games? Like, why wouldn't you play the games? And for me, as someone who loves The Last of Us and obviously loves video games, I always think, but like, people have their mediums that they go to. And yeah, that might, The Last of Us might convince people that video games are something they could be interested in and can experience. But I reckon broadening the audience to people who, you know, maybe don't like video games, or maybe don't like the systems in them, or maybe just want the story and want the performances and want the themes, can kind of get them as well. Like, I don't see an issue personally in adapting something as cinematic as The Last of Us if it brings in new audiences who would have never experienced that otherwise. Like, it's never going to replace the original. I still prefer the games over the TV show. But the fact that I can now talk about The Last of Us with my dad and people who, you know, don't have that interest in games and probably never will, and we can talk about Joel, we can talk about Ellie, we can talk about the Fireflies. Like, I just think that's cool, and in and of itself justifies those straightforward adaptations.
Yes, that's lovely. What a lovely little thought. Completely. Nico Tized asks, what video game would you like to see reimagined in a different genre / gameplay style? Think similar to God of War 3 to God of War 2018.
Ooh. That is the template, isn't it? Like, that was,
yeah, that's
such
the ideal.
A transformation. Does anything come to mind for you while I ever think?
Weirdly, I think Turok needs to come back.
Yo!
And if you want to make, like, I feel like it's an IP that has just a little spattering of nostalgia, but not enough that it's like, if you made a new game, people would compare it to the old ones. It's like, okay, it's, you could do something fresh with it, modernize it in some way, make it mature like a God of War 2018, or maybe even lean towards something like a Doom or a Far Cry. Like, there's so many things you can do. Well, not like, I don't want radio towers in Turok, but, you know, like an open world survival thing. It's such a cool... We need more dinosaurs, basically, is what I'm saying.
And really Turok
is a perfect place to do that with video games right now.
Do you know what? That would not have been something I pulled from at all, but now you mention it, Turok Far Cry would be amazing. I want to play that game.
How has that not happened?
You know, I played the originals a little bit, but the Turok reboot on Xbox 360 was actually my proper first introduction to the series. And I still remember being blown away by the foliage technology in that game. When you stealthed your way through the grass actually responded to your movements. It wasn't just a static thing. And that's another one where I just kind of bought it thinking, oh, I've heard of this before. It's got a bow and arrow in it. It's got dinosaurs in it. I'm sold. And then really, really enjoyed it, even though it wasn't that well received. That's such a great shout. Turok definitely should come back in some form. For me, I'd probably go, bear with me, I've got a few now, Bioshock, but as an open world RPG.
Ooh, I could see that.
Something probably akin to kind of Cyberpunk
2077.
Like, keep the 2077 right there, that's correct, maybe.
Yes.
keep the sort of first person approach, but make, like, doesn't have to be a Rapture, doesn't have to be a Columbia, can be an entirely new city, but make it a proper explorable city and allow us to get to know the inhabitants, take on quests, maybe even change the course of the city, its fate or its destiny or whatever. I just think there's the storytelling in those games, and but especially the world building in those games, are so strong that, I don't know, I just feel like, and this isn't me slagging off first-person shooters, I love first-person shooters, but it feels like it's ripe for choice-based gameplay or kind of exploration-based gameplay, as much as it is, you know, shooting and fighting or whatever.
I think, you know, to its benefit, some of the systems in Bioshock, I've only played the first one, so I can only use that as sort of a template, but they're quite simple, like the plasmids and stuff like that, straightforward. But I would be really interested to see them sort of widened out a bit, and you can, like, as you say about RPG aspects, upgrading plasmids and putting experience into them to making them better and stuff like that would be cool, as well as your character. I could see that.
And make it maybe part of the world. I know you already have this a little bit in the BioShock games, but, you know, incorporate the plasmids into the open world exploration, like, you know, certain plasmids allowing you to unlock certain doors, make it a bit of, you know, kind of do it Arkham City style and add some Metroidvania elements into there to kind of keep exploration you know, enjoyable. I definitely would prefer a smaller open world and not a Just Cause one, but, you know, something really densely packed, I think that could work really well. But I'm not a game designer, so who knows? Maybe the everyone who worked on BioShock, because they're definitely listening to this, will be saying, "What a terrible idea, Josh. That absolutely sucks."
Speaking of terrible slash good ideas, Elfar Oliver asks, what is your co-worker's best gaming opinion? It doesn't have to be the person sitting next to you. You can give anyone a shout out. I'm just going to go in with Dan Durkin and his Elden Ring hate, obviously.
No.
Yeah, there's talk about bouncing off genres. Soulsborne for me, can't get into. We've talked about this a little bit before, but parry mechanics just don't do anything for me. And anytime one shows up in a game out of nowhere, just to be like, look, we can do a Soulsborne. I'm like, oh, go away. So he and I are on the same page there with, he's a father, so he's got very little time to game. And I'm just heinously busy most of the time. So I have less time to game than I'd like. I don't want to spend 2 hours just trying to fight one dude over and over again. Personally, that's just me. Sorry, everyone.
Hey, I get it. I totally get it. You know, I slip into a black hole when I play those games where I am entirely focused on them to the detriment of my health, I think, at sometimes. I become so focused on them that it is both beautiful and disgusting. So I get definitely not wanting to fall into that hole. God, it feels like there's so many, but I can't think of any off the top of my head. Because me and Scott, especially when we do these podcasts, butt heads so much that I don't just want to say the stuff that I've kind of said before about, you know, I obviously agree with Scott on his approach to microtransactions and the industry as a whole. I'm trying to think, you know. I mean, me and Dan Durkin both are lovers of virtual reality. I know you're dabbling in that now, Si. You may be a believer as well. I think, you know what? I'm going to go with Dan Durkin as well, because he is similarly embracing the VR space and has loved games like Resident Evil 4, the original version, and a bunch of other titles that we've played together as well on the channel. And yeah, me, you, and Dan Durkin are forming the bedrock of the virtual reality rebellion, and one day we will make Scott Tailford a true believer to the point where he owns one of these headsets.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
I don't want to spoil a future video, but there is a moment in VR where you can see his inner child come out.
Yes.
So I think it's begun, thankfully. But yeah, like famously, I now own a VR headset because of that Resident Evil 4 challenge we did. I was like, yep, well, I have to get this. I'm going to spend 200 and whatever pounds now just to play Resident Evil 4 again.
Yes.
Because it was in VR, because it was so good. And it is so good. So
that's it. Once you get your hands on it yourself, or your eyes on it, or your face on it, it's just, you're like, oh, okay, I understand now. At least I hope that's the case, you know.
It's a lot of good rhythm games in VR too as well, so that's a weakness.
As a man who has no rhythm, I am so grateful for the likes of Beat Saber and Pistol Whip. It's allowed my body to move in ways I never thought it could. It's activated muscles I never thought I had.
Speaking of Dan Durkin, he actually asked the next question, wouldn't you know?
Legend.
I guess it wouldn't be the UBP now without some kind of food conversation. So we have to revive the crisp culture discussion. It's often in the gaming channel group chat. If you had to eat one type of crisp for the rest of your life, what would it be? I think he's being sarcastic here. Mine would be Walker's roast chicken.
You know what? I'd actually wouldn't put it past Dan Durkin. He's an absolute crisp fiend. I think he'd choose Walker's roast chicken, but I don't know.
Maybe he's doing it to needle you, because you don't like meat flavored crisps. Is that?
I'm not a huge fan. I think I said in the last maybe UBP with you side, there are no bad crisps. Let me get that out the gate. But there are crisps that are better than others, and meat crisps are certainly at the bottom of the list every single time. And so are slabs, since Dan introduced me to slabs, which are too thick and too hard, and they're not for me. I'm going to have to actually rack my brains, because there are so many contenders, and this is such an important question that I don't want to give a wrong answer.
Nice.
So I'm going to make you go first.
Mine's going to be simple, because quite simply, I have the evidence that I basically live off these anyway. I don't know if I'd said this before, maybe on a different pod, but they did this, you know, the Spotify Wrapped, and everyone's doing their Here's Your Year's Wrapped. I think I mentioned this to you. Tesco did one at the end of the year, Unbagged or whatever it was. I don't remember, but it was like, here's how much you spent here's the most bought thing you bought Tesco's using your club card points, blah, 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 blah. And there was one for meal deal.
Oh.
And it gave me, here's your main, your side and your drink that you've bought the most. And I looked at it and was like, yeah, that's what I get every single time. And the crisps is the Walker's Max, you know, like the thick, I don't know how you describe that. I don't want to say ribbed. That sounds weird.
Ridged, maybe?
Ridged, yeah. The paprika flavored those, I get them every time. So clearly it's that. I could live off of those, because I do, apparently.
Walker's Max in totality is truly goated. I am obsessed with the Walker's Max. I think it's called Flamin' Hot Prawn Cocktail. They are
interesting.
Downright my most favorite crisp at this moment in time. I would eat them for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So right now I'd have to go with those Walker's Max Prawn Cocktail, but I think, generally speaking, I'm going to go pickled onion Walkers, which are a rarity, of course, but they've never failed. They to quote Gary Neville, they are the banker. They're the ones who have never failed. They're the ones who will never fail. They are sensational. And maybe it's because they are only rare that I feel like I can say this, but I can't imagine me ever getting sick of anything pickled onion flavored.
I was going to say, one of my backup answers is pickled onion monster munch, so I completely agree. Even though you literally get six in a bag now these days, I counted.
It's true. Criminal. Even the grab bags, what the hell is going on there?
No, it's just a bigger bag with the same amount of crisps in it.
You know what, Si? Thinking about this. Yeah, it's absolutely right. Monster Munch might be the only make of crisps where I've never had a bad batch. I don't recall ever opening up any packet of Monster Munch and thinking, ooh, that wasn't a great set. I've kind of gone off them now. Whereas sometimes Walkers, you get some that are overdone too hard or whatever it is. But Monster Munch, they never fail.
Always good. They don't mess with it, do they? There's only, I think, there's three flavors and they've made like one temporary one, I remember, for a limited time. But it's just three flavors. And that's it. They don't mess about.
That's true. You know exactly what you're getting.
What more do you want?
Saiji, watch Jackass at all? Well, maybe not now, but did you ever?
Yeah, about 20 years ago.
Well, I'm an unashamed Jackass mark again.
Like, are you going to tell me about Steve-O?
I'm going to talk about Steve-O.
Yeah.
Because my love for Steve-O skyrocketed when I found out about his love for pickled onion Monster Munch. The fact that he's got a tattoo of it, the fact that he's genuinely mad for them. And I'm like, look, man, I get it. They are addictive. They are beautiful. And they never fail.
I swear there's an interview where he's like eating bags of them. And he says, I've literally flown to the UK to buy them and come back once. And he's just like laughing to himself at how ridiculous that is. But he just can't stop. He's just like eats like three or four bags in a row while doing this interview.
And you know what?
What a legend.
If it was Dan Durkin's roast chicken Walkers, I'd be thinking, I don't get it, Steve-O. But when he mentions pickled onion Monster Munch, absolutely. Any Americans or any international people listening to this, definitely go out and seek these bad boys down. I like that they always use them on, Snack Wars. I don't watch it much, but I think it's the Lad Bible show where they, get American celebrities to try British food and stuff. Monster Munch is almost always on that, or at least the ones that I've seen. And I don't think I've seen anyone hate a Monster Munch yet.
It's a delicacy, that's why. You do need to, if you fly over here, you do need to try it. Fish and chips, roast dinner, Monster Munch. Those are the cornerstones of British cuisine.
Absolutely. I'd throw in a beans on toast as well. But, that's just
of course
me.
You would, yeah. Not a balled up bit of bread.
Bean sandwich.
Miss Snowy UK, I don't know what your feelings on Pokemon are, but asks what Pokemon speaks to you the most and why?
Ooh, yeah.
That with Pokemon?
Never been much of a Pokemon fan, but funnily enough, this actually links in to what I was talking about with The Sims earlier. Like, I never really played the games when I was little, but I watched Pokemon the movie to death. And if I recall correctly, you might be able to correct me if I'm wrong, Si, but I'm pretty sure it's Mewtwo in that film who was kind of racked over the idea that his life has no purpose or something.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that as a kid thinking, yeah, what is the purpose of life? Like, why am I here? I think it was genuinely the movie that introduced me to existentialism. So Mewtwo has always been my go-to for that reason.
Incredible. Out of anything I could have predicted, it was not that. I love that. I'm going to go the other way and be really obvious with it. I've got to do the trans stereotype thing and say Sylveon. It's the fairy type Eevee evolution that's just the trans rights flag.
Is it really?
That's nice. Yeah,
oh,
that's
I'm not familiar
thing.
With that Pokemon.
Literally, no one can see this, but I'm literally wearing the shirt today with it on. And the other obvious one is Snorlax.
Yes.
Eat, sleep.
Yes.
That's what life's about. There's your existentialism right there.
That is absolutely true. You know what? In my as I've grown, I used to hate. I'm going to mangle all of these really obvious Pokemon names. It's Bulbasaur, right? I used to dislike Bulbasaur. It used to be my least favorite of the starting Pokemon. And now I've come around to Bulbasaur, man. He's a little freak. He's a little strange little guy, and I relate to him a lot, at least aesthetically. And the older I get, I'm like, yeah, you got something about you, my friend.
I was waiting for a reason why you hated him, but you just went, you're just like, no reason. Just...
No reason, just, you know, no. At least when I was a kid, you know, I went towards Charmander, you know, Charmander, fire, stereotypical young boy, he's the red one. Then as I got older, it was Squirtle. And now as I get a little bit older, maybe Bulbasaur, maybe next time I play a Pokemon game in 20 years' time, that'll be my starting Pokemon.
As a aging 30-year-old, I can appreciate that, because Bulbasaur's evolutionary line essentially just gets bigger, more wrinkly, and more tired. Like, the Bulbasaur to Venusaur, that's basically what happens. It just goes from Bulbasaur to Venusaur. Like, it's just like, I'm sick of this.
I'm over it. Too old basically.
Matt Paint 13 says, with N64 games being £69 in the past, are games good value now, or were they overpriced back then? Which is a really great question, actually. I don't know if they went quite as high as £69, but it was in that sort of ballpark, because I remember there being some controversy at the time, as is, you know, was the case, still sometimes is the case, is we're a little bit stiffed on pricing and stuff. And the N64 was really bad for that. When the console came out, it was way overpriced. And the games we paid in it a little bit more than America would for games that came, you know, 9 months late as well on top of it. But it is a really interesting question in terms of how you value an experience.
Yeah, it's, you know, because a lot of people, you know, probably rightly so, say that in terms of inflation, games have stayed relatively steady, right? They went up from $60 to $70, but in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem like much. To me, that's only part of the conversation, though, because while, yeah, the price of a base game hasn't really gone up, we are being monetized in so many other areas. You know, just this week it was announced that the Ultimate Edition of Star Wars Outlaws is going to be $120, and all you really get for that is 3 days early access and some digital fluff, like not even a statue or not even a physical art book or anything like that. So in a way, I do think that as games have become bigger, as the production cost of them have skyrocketed, it is surprising and arguably really good value that we can pay $70 for a game and get 100 hours of quality entertainment for it if you're getting something good. But I don't think it's the norm enough to call it good value across the board, because I'd argue that games now are more inconsistent than they ever have been in terms of that launch code. Like back in the N64 days, right, if you shipped a broken game, that game was going to be almost certainly broken forever unless they released brand new cartridges to replace the old ones, right? Whereas now, if you buy in day one for that $70 price point, you might get the worst version of the game. Like, I think if you pay $120 for the Ultimate Edition of Star Wars Outlaws, like, chances are you're paying that high price point for a game that could theoretically be a complete buggy mess if Ubisoft's track record has anything to go by. So I think on the surface it seems like good value, but if you kind of, for me, if you dig under it, there is much more anti-consumer stuff pushed on us now than there was when those games were being sold for £69 way back when.
Yeah, and also similarly, like, the fact that people have, keen to point out, rightfully as they should, you don't really buy your video games anymore. You buy a license to play a video game.
Yeah.
Like, you're spending money on the ability to play it until the servers shut off. It doesn't even have to necessarily be an online game, but video games now are in a state where you could suddenly lose the ability to play them. Whereas buying an N64 cartridge in this case, it's until the cartridge dies, it works forever. You put it in your machine, it just works. So, yeah, there's that aspect to it as well. But largely, I agree. I do. It's funny when you sort of, like, obviously the first thing that comes to mind when you compare them is just how much more visual fidelity and everything else we've got these days. It's crazy that we are spending the same amount of money, or close to, considering games take years to make these ridiculous projects. Whereas I think his Majora's Mask was turned around in like 6 months or something ridiculous, because it's mostly an asset flip. And that probably would have been, you know, a full £60-70 when it came out. So, yeah, there's nuance there. But, yeah, largely I agree with everything that you just said.
That's it. It's a really nuanced question. And I don't even think I'm right or anything. It's definitely an opinion in progress, because it's such a big topic. For me personally, I just think I look at the profits and the revenue that gaming makes, right? And that has been as far as I'm aware, a major increase from the N64 days. Like, gaming right now is the biggest entertainment medium in the world. It brings in the most revenue. Games now can make more money than they ever have. Like, it's commonplace for games to break 1 billion and then continue to make billions of dollars if you're something like Grand Theft Auto or FIFA or Call of Duty through microtransactions. So those profits have gone up, and I personally would not champion a developer for keeping the $70 price point the same just because of that reason. Because, production costs have skyrocketed, but so has the revenue that you're getting from those production costs, right?
Yes.
And, you know, you mentioned digital, and that's a great point about, like, not really even owning those games. But I also think digital stores are kind of a ripoff. Like, if you go on the PlayStation Store and you buy something for, you know, say you pre-order Stellar Blade for £70, the publishers and those big companies are getting more money from that sale than they would for a £69 game back in the day, because they're cutting out the retailers, right? They don't have to pay them anything in that regard. They, of course, will, you know, have to chuck some money up to Sony, for instance, if it's a third-party game, but you're cutting out a lot of the costs of physical production and what have you. So you're kind of making more money off every sale anyway. So it's kind of like they're not keeping the price the same out the goodness of their heart. They're keeping the price the same because they found other ways to maximize what that £70 means to the company. So that's just my thought on it. It's complicated. I could be very wrong, like I say. I'm interested to see what other people think about that.
Indeed. Luke Cullen asks, what do you think was the biggest open goal in gaming, be it story, sequel not done, a character coming in or leaving, gameplay mechanic, etc., that wasn't taken? Big love to What Culture and congratulations to Scott. I mean, the first one, media, again, it's a really obvious one, but PT is just ridiculous, of course. Like, I wasn't even as crazy about it as everyone else. But the idea of a, you know, Kojima Silent Hill is open goal is absolutely the term. And I just, it's ridiculous that it never happened. But there you go.
Can't agree more, Si. That is, I mean, there's a reason people still clamor for it today and think that every time Kojima is making a new project, it might be Silent Hills, because that was such an obvious win. And I think that one hurts more because, seemingly, if you read into the reports, it was only canned kind of out of spite more than anything else. Rather than it being like a knock on the quality or real estate expectations or whatever. So that makes it sting even more, I think, because it feels like a needless victim. It feels like they've gone up to take a penalty. They've got an open goal and they've purposefully like burst the ball. They've just like gone, no, we're not doing this and you can't enjoy this either. For me, I've got two. And one is quite obvious, I think, just making no DLC for Grand Theft Auto 5. And I mean single-player DLC.
Oh my god, yeah.
Having no expansions, you know, that game ran for, well, it's still running, you know, 11 years on nearly, and we got so many updates for GTA Online, but the fact that we never got to play around in that world from a single-player perspective, to me, is, it's a little bit tragic, because I love the characters. I love the three central characters in that game, and if you look back, or in my opinion anyway, if you look back to GTA 4, the best content for GTA 4, I thought, was the expansion packs.
I was just going to say, they're really popular, aren't they? Yeah. DLC and GTA 4, so it is shocking.
And imagine what you could do when GTA 5 moved to the next-gen only machines and stopped supporting the Xbox 360, which is crazy to say that it was ever on Xbox 360. I just, again, I imagined, like, what could a GTA 5 expansion pack that was exclusive to next-gen consoles at the time achieve? Like, how could it push that game forward and innovate and bring features that weren't possible while Rockstar were developing the main version of it?
You know what? You just talking about it made me realize what I actually want is like an undead nightmare for GTA 5.
Yeah.
Give me a post-apocalyptic version of Los Santos with zombies in it.
Oh, I would take it. I really would. You know, especially when Red Dead Redemption 2 came out and I just thought, all the stuff that you've implemented here, bring it over and then make an undead nightmare for Red Dead 2 as well. Just keep making undead nightmares. Speaking of Fallout, though, it would be remiss of me not to say an open goal that hasn't been accomplished is New Vegas 2. There's so much fan adoration for that game, and the original was so hampered by the tight schedule that Obsidian Entertainment were on making the game, which kind of arguably tanked it at launch because it was full of inexcusable bugs, I suppose, and it didn't have the reputation of a Fallout 3 or even a Fallout 4. But time has been so kind to that game, and I think if we're going to have to wait a decade, maybe even longer, for Fallout 5, New Vegas 2 is right there. People would lap that up, keep the franchise in people's minds. God damn, it's the best Fallout game. At least a remaster, come on.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to bang the drum then for the Resident Evil Classic Collection.
Yes.
And I've said it before, but I'll say it again. It's ridiculous that all these classic collections are coming out, and Capcom have made loads of them. There's the Phoenix Wrights ones now. There's some Castlevania ones. There's like a dozen Mega Man ones, it feels like. And games like Street Fighter 1 are available today on all platforms, which is a bad game. Street Fighter 2 goated, Street Fighter 1, pointless, crappy arcade game that was the springboard for success. But Resident Evil 1, 2, and 3, pretty much you can't play them unless you go far back to the original console. 2 and 3, the last time they got ported forward was the GameCube. And I think they're on the PS3 store, and the Resident Evil 1 was on the PS3 store and is now brought forward as part of PS Now. But the fact they haven't put them in a collection is absurd. It's like, yeah, their biggest franchise, if not second to Monster Hunter. So I think it has to be coming. It's just a matter of timing it with something, maybe. I don't know, but money left on the table for sure.
It's got to happen, because like you say, you know, you can get the director's cut of Resi 1 on PlayStation Now, but that arrived years ago. Why haven't there been further releases at least in that form? It is absolutely crazy to me that both that and, to be fair, Silent Hill as well are so difficult to get your hands on in their original forms. Like, I'm very lucky to own a PS1 copy of Silent Hill 1.
Nice.
But to buy that secondhand now, it's like £100, and these are seminal games. And in the case of Resident Evil, I think it's inexcusable, because that is such a huge franchise, like you say, and constantly in the conversation. We're constantly getting new games and remakes of those classic titles, yet those classic titles have been left to languish in obscurity for the most part. I would have just been able to play through that original trilogy back to back if it's an emulation on PS Now or what. And I also want to see them bring back like the spin-offs, like let me play Outbreak or whatever, you know, like
that's the thing.
It's a rich franchise, and I want to see them give it a bit more attention.
Yes, that's the thing for me, is I won't stop banging the drum once they put 1, 2, and 3 out. I need Dead Aim and all the other stupid crap, because otherwise I don't want it to get lost on the PS2 forever. You can't leave it on a console from 20 years ago. That's ridiculous. So, yeah, the classic collection of Resident Evil for me is 1, 2, 3, and then unlockable Resident Evil Survivor for the PlayStation 1. Because you can't just let these... Even if they were crap games, they're an important part of a big franchise. It's just silly to me that we're leaving them behind.
Absolutely. You know, I fully agree with it. You know, in terms of a fan perspective, in terms of a historical archive perspective, charting that journey is one of my favorite things to do in games. You know, I mentioned going through the God of War titles, and it's just like a thrill to see where we are now and look back to what we had, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. And Resident Evil, I think it's crazy that something like Resident Evil Operation Raccoon City or Umbrella Corps is more readily available than Resident Evil 2 or Resident Evil 3 Nemesis. And that's something's gone wrong there, surely.
Indeed. Well, that's been the Untitled Banter Podcast, the UBP, the UBP, the UBP. I've been your host, Si White. That's been Josh Brown.
Thank you for having me on, Si. It's been absolutely lovely.
You say that like I'm the host normally.
Yeah, well, you're the
host. Thank you for allowing me.
You're the host now, Scottsway. You didn't have to choose me, so I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.